you're listening to the UBC Medicine Learning Network.
This podcast was recorded on the traditional, ancestral, and stolen lands of the Musqueam people. We are committed to ensuring Indigenous women's rights to health and safety, and the equal opportunity to participate in a manner that recognizes and respects Indigenous cultures and traditions.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Women's Health Interrupted podcast. I'm Sarah Williscraft.
And I'm Chevy Mehra.
Today, we are talking to Dr. Claudia Barth about brain health and menopause. For nearly 10 years, Dr. Barth has been working on the front line of women's health research by exploring the effects of hormonal transition states on mental illnesses and the brain. In her current role as senior researcher at the University of Oslo and the Norwegian Center for Mental Disorders Research, she serves as co-chair of the Enigma Early Onset Psychosis Working Group to foster global research collaborations on this topic. Dr. Barth also co-founded the Women's Neuro Network to enhance collaboration and academic excellence among female neuroscientists and actively combats known gender imbalances in academia. Thank you so much, Dr. Barth, for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation.
What are some of the hormonal changes that happen to the brain during menopause?
So menopause, by definition, is just kind of this one point in time when women haven't had their period for 12 months. So preceding menopause is like the so-called perimenopausal transition, where sex hormone levels start to gradually decline, but also show much more volatile fluctuations, which leads to disruptions in menstrual cycle length and other symptoms. And most generally known as kind of the decrease in estrogen levels, which is due to kind of age-related senescence of the ovarian or of the reproductive tract. Ovarian function starts failing, and that leads to the transition to menopause. Not to kind of overwhelm listeners, I think the most important change is the decline in estrogen levels.
So Dr. Barth, you alluded to symptoms earlier, which is a perfect thread to our next question. How do symptoms of these hormonal changes manifest in someone's day-to-day life?
So the manifestation can be very, very different and is very, very much varies between women. But most commonly reported symptoms are hot flashes, night sweats, vasomotor symptoms, but also very commonly sleep disturbances, women sleep worse, then also disturbances in their mood and cognitive functioning. Based on how they transition and how prevalent these symptoms are, how long they last and how severe they are, then women can have very debilitating symptoms. So that varies a lot. But there's more and more research in like trying to find predictors of who might undergo these transitions with more severe symptoms. But generally, yes, these constellation of symptoms is often referred to the menopausal syndrome, and insomnia and depression can also be very prevalent.
And are these symptoms permanent or do they wear off post-menopause?
So some women definitely will transition without any kind of long-term adverse effects, which is great. But in especially the women who might have more symptoms during this transition, they might be at a higher risk of more accelerated brain aging, including like cognitive decline or also increased risk for Alzheimer's disease.
And you mentioned sort of increased risk of depression during menopause. How does, and that's interesting because we've been sort of wanting to know a little bit more about how menopause impacts someone's mental health. Could you elaborate on that?
So generally across the female lifespan, any kind of transition periods where massive hormonal changes might occur, and that could be the menstrual cycle, pregnancy, and equally also perimenopausal transition when hormones fluctuate and decline, it could be kind of a stable trait that women who are also experience symptoms across the menstrual cycle, particularly in the premenstrual phase or after giving birth, they might also be susceptible to mood disturbances such as depression during the perimenopausal transition. But it can also be the new occurrence of depressive symptoms because there's a massive restructuring of the female brain during the transition to menopause, and the decline in estrogen can kind of disrupt systems, which might actually lead to kind of a normal functioning of the brain. And in some women, that might then lead to depression. But a big risk factor for depression during perimenopause is a history of previous depression. So then it's kind of more seen as a stable trait. But it can also newly occur in this transition phase. And it's not clearly understood why. But what also needs to be considered, besides all the biological changes which happened during the transition to menopause, that there are also a lot of changes in the social life of most women. Midlife is associated with changes in relationships. If women have kids, they might actually move out. So there's also quite kind of restructuring of the social life. Employment changes in midlife can also have an impact on mental health. So there are so many factors which need to be considered together to actually get a full understanding how transition to menopause in midlife can increase the risk for mental health disturbances.
Do we know if menopause can increase risk of neurological disorders such as schizophrenia?
Interestingly, similar to depression, that these kind of hormonal shifts across the female lifespan can trigger in some women a heightened risk for psychosis, including psychotic disorders, including schizophrenia. What is particularly interesting in the case of schizophrenia, because normally, well, relatively normally, it's perceived as being more prevalent in males than in females, with an peak onset in like late adolescence, early adulthood, and then it's mainly men or males who are diagnosed in this range. For women, there's actually, on females, there's then this kind of secondary peak when they transition to menopause. And this is definitely an area of ongoing research to understand why, if they've been fine all their life, why they suddenly have to deal with potential new onset schizophrenia. And as a reference, schizophrenia is a very severe psychotic disorder, including negative symptoms with like depression-like and also apathy, and positive symptoms like hallucinations and delusions, trying to understand why suddenly women become susceptible and later in their life, although they were fine earlier, is of critical importance. Luckily, it is fairly rare, so it's not that it's very frequent, but it's definitely, if it happens, it needs medical attention and treatment. And of course, it would be nice, and it's the goal, similar to the onset of depression, to be able to predict if that might happen and intervene early.
I have a quick follow-up question on that. How long has sort of that connection been observed? Increased risk of psychosis during menopause. Is that something that is a new area of study?
No, not really. I know exactly or when it was first established, but that is like kind of a very long or like very known epidemiological findings when people study the prevalence of certain diseases across the lifespan, because it's very rare, luckily. And because it mainly occurs in males during adolescence, like late adolescence, early adulthood, like a lot of research has focused on this phase. But there's not as much research in this like later life phase in women.
Thank you, Dr. Barth, for your insight. On that vein of, you know, symptoms ranging from moderate to severe, and then you also talked about how there's lack of women's health research. Why do you believe this area of female brain health is understudied?
Centuries of patriarchy. No, but it's definitely a systemic issue, which is luckily changing because the topic is gaining more and more momentum. People are more and more educated on these issues. Really happy to do this kind of research now. And I'm really happy that there are so many other people before me and also currently who are strong advocates in this field, like Lisa Galea. And I think, yeah, for the longest time, the male body and male biology was set as the default, and it was just assumed that women won't be, or females won't be, much different than that, which is wrong. But it was for the longest time the default. And also, for the longest time, women were not allowed to participate in the process. They were not allowed to get higher education, to do research themselves. So a lot of topics were, or like research topics were informed by the interests and needs of the researchers at the time, which were who were male or man. And also like moving forward, because I'm kind of switching between male and female and man and women, because like what I personally do is a lot of like focusing on biological processes, so looking at biological sex. But of course, when it comes to, for instance, what I touched on, this biopsychosocial framework to understand risk for mental health issues, it's also moving forward. It would be nice to incorporate more and more like also the gender perspective on that. But so far, most studies do not account for that. So most data sets we use to answer research questions are based on like the binary biological sex variable. So hopefully moving forward, we can then inform on gender effects in male and men, women, and also gender diverse individuals.
And as we are thinking about possible ways forward, what are some questions you have or are currently exploring that the medical field has yet to understand about this topic?
Oh, there are a lot of things, but of course, linking back to what I said earlier, like understanding these biopsychosocial frameworks could be very powerful because of their complexity. A lot of these topics are always like kind of studied in isolation. It's hard to kind of tie it together. But I think in clinical practice, when doctors actually see patients or clients with symptoms, then this biopsychosocial framework is much more important to actually really tailor treatment and tailor predictions of outcomes to the person you're trying to treat. On a more research level, I think there are more and more like mechanisms which pop up are thought to be important. For instance, one line of research we're interested in is that the menopausal transition seems to trigger a change in the immune system, and how this kind of change in the immune system might lead to cognitive decline or risk for Alzheimer's disease is of interest, but also in the context of mental health, because women are at a higher risk of autoimmune diseases also after the transition to menopause. So trying to kind of understand these mechanisms could also help to prevent or ideally in the long term be able to detect and prevent these kind of negative outcomes.
That's great. I don't know if there was anything else you feel like we missed or another topic you'd like to discuss.
Yeah, maybe what, because I really realized that with like my mom transitioning from menopause at the time when she did, which was over 10 years ago, I did not as a daughter and as like a kind of person, I am close to my mom, I did not have the knowledge to actually help her either. And looking back with the knowledge I have now could have helped her going to seek help or seek treatment. And I think that's very important. So there are kind of these two levels that you educate women about their symptoms and what their healthcare options are, but also kind of educating the general public, also men, about these things so they can be helpful partners in these processes. That would be important for me maybe to include or like communicate that I feel education should be general. And ideally, moving forward, we had sex education, which covered like menstrual cycle and pregnancy, but it didn't cover menopause. So maybe moving forward, it might be actually nice to include that in our early curriculums where we cover actually sexual and reproductive health, and menopause belongs to that and should be talked about.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Barth, for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation. I was happy to talk about that.
We would also like to thank the UBC Medicine Learning Network, the University of British Columbia, and everyone that has donated to the Women's Health Research Cluster for their support of this project.
If you want to help transform women's health on a global scale, donate to the Women's Health Research Cluster today at www.womenshealthresearch.ubc.ca.
If you liked the episode and want to hear more, be sure to subscribe on whichever platform you get your podcasts on to be notified when new episodes drop every second Wednesday of the month.
And check out our show notes online to dig into the resources we talked about today.
We also have other exciting women's health research being shared on our women's health blog
and through events like the Women's Health Seminar Series. So make sure to head over to our website at womenshealthresearch.ubc.ca to learn more. Until next time, I'm Chavi Mehra.
And I'm Sarah Williscraft. Thanks for listening.
This has been a presentation of the UBC Medicine Learning Network.